Hello, and welcome to episode 81 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
I have a simple thesis. That is that there's no better time to be living in America. America is not at war. Unemployment is at historic lows. We've come very far, with work yet to be done, in becoming a more accepting society for all. We are as close to energy independent as we've ever been. Our manufacturing is making a comeback, and people lined up for vaccines created in U.S. labs. Yet when I shared some of these thoughts on social media, I was called naive and overly optimistic. Rick, I still stand by my view. However, I know many in this country, especially young people, are facing high levels of stress and anxiety. Am I looking at things through rose-colored glasses? Or are people simply not realizing that, as Americans, we've never had it better?
Yeah, this is such a puzzling question because on most of the objective measures of how we're doing, and you look at what's been going on for over the last 50 years, say, like take a longer-term view, you don't want to look at just what's happened since the pandemic. That kind of has skewed a lot of data. But crime is going down. We're in the longest sustained period of without serious global conflict in years since World War II, really.
Mm-hmm. And again, not to diminish the horrible things that are going on in Ukraine, but that's not a worldwide problem right now.
Right. It's at the present time anyway. It's pretty much limited to those countries, and we've had a reduction in all kinds of diseases. Life expectancy has been going up. Global poverty has been going way down. The economy in the United States, for the most part, has been fantastic over the last 50 years. I mean, anybody who's kind of been invested long-term in the stock market has had, great returns. But not just that. I mean, the quality of things you can buy, like what the dollar will buy, is so much greater than it has been at any other time in our history. And so all those objective measures, we're doing great. However, people are feeling much worse
about
their lives.
And that's what I just find so interesting. And I'm sure that's kind of what we're going to talk about on much of today's show, I think. But like I said, when I posted about this, and it was a friend, the way this happened is a friend and I were talking about this. And I kind of made this point to him, and he pushed back and said I wasn't quite right. So he posted my thoughts on his social media page and said, what do folks think? And tagged me in the conversation. And nobody really agreed with me, I'll say that. And a few people were saying, pointing out things that we're not doing all that well on right now. And I said, yeah, I mean, sure. I could, just as you listed a lot of things we're doing great, I could certainly list things where we could do better. But I kept asking the question. I said, fine. When would you rather live? Would you rather live in the 1960s in America? Would you rather live in the 1920s, in the 1850s? I mean, at what period of time would you rather be living in America than today? And most people didn't have an answer. One person said, well, the 60s and 70s would have been an interesting time to live through. Well, I'm sure it would have been. There was a lot of change going on in America today. I mean, I guess we're having a lot of change right now. But I don't think that's any better. I mean, I can tell you, as someone who is gay, I don't think I would have wanted to be living in the 1960s. I mean, that would have been a much less accepting time. And I just don't feel like we have the appreciation of that. But like you said, and I think this is where we should probably pivot most of the conversation, is that even if all that's true, there is this feeling across much of Americans that things aren't great. And they can, if you ask them why, they will give you a long list of things that aren't great. And I guess I'm still stuck on that disconnect.
Well, they'll give you a long list of things that aren't great, and a lot of them will just be wrong. Like, I mean, we've talked on this podcast before about people thinking that life expectancy is getting worse. Well, temporarily it has dropped a bit since the pandemic, but
and just to pause, most of that because of the pandemic and because of some significant substance abuse issues.
Right, right. Yeah, and like most crime statistics have been getting better for quite a while. They go up and down year by year, but the things that people are really concerned about, except for something like, you know, climate change, and yet for most of us in our experience, that's really a projection about what's going to happen in the future. We really aren't seeing the negative consequences in our daily lives at this point, which is, I think, one of the problems, the reasons we aren't dealing with it more effectively, taking it more seriously, is we're not really seeing the consequences yet.
A couple of weeks ago, I guess, back in February, there was a tweet that was sent out by a woman named Taylor Lorenz, and she is a reporter for the Washington Post, and she has a large social media following, and is a younger person and spends a lot of her time online. And this was when a lot of the research was showing that, you know, phones and electronics and how people interact with those things are really driving a lot of this problem. And her tweet was kind of pushing back on that, and it was, quote, "People are like, why are kids so depressed? It must be their phones. But they never mention the fact that we're living in a late-stage capitalist hellscape during an ongoing deadly pandemic with record wealth inequality, zero social safety net, no job security as climate change cooks the world." And I just read that and I'm like, well, there's clearly things in there that just aren't true. I mean, first of all, we don't have no social safety net, and many people have job security. But even setting that aside, I think it really captures how a lot of people are feeling. And even though I don't agree with Taylor, a lot of people do. And that's, I guess, what worries me.
Yeah, the idea that we're living in a late-stage capitalist hellscape. I mean, that kind of sums up the whole attitude. Well, here's the problem. It's all attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not a recitation of kind of the objective conditions under which we're living right now. It's just the attitude about, I agree with you. You find a lot of people that share that attitude. When I've been giving some talks in the past year or so that really use a lot of graphs from Our World in Data, which gives you a pretty good look, links to all kinds of studies collecting data on what's going on in the world. And most of it's really positive, right? I have a lot of people who thank me for kind of reminding us that the world isn't as bad as everybody is saying, like kind of acknowledging, like, we're told every day the world is terrible, and you've just shown us that it's not that bad and kind of shown it objectively. But I've also had others in this, and the people that have objected in this way have all been fellow academics, have told me, but it's irresponsible to give such a positive message because then people won't take the problem seriously. And I think that's just wrong.
Yeah, well, and I heard an interview a few weeks ago by two of my favorite people, probably not terribly widely known to most people listening, but Ian Bremmer, who's an expert when it comes to foreign policy, and he's interviewing Scott Galloway, who's pretty deep in the tech world. And they were just having kind of an open-ended conversation. But I think Scott Galloway made the point. He said that we live in a society, and have been for a while now, where we always have an infinite news cycle, that every 24 hours there's one big story after another big story after another big story. And oftentimes those are, you know, sometimes bad news. We have, and there are bad things that are happening in the world. I don't think I can speak for Rick here, that we know that there are, you know, mass shootings, and that's an awful thing. And we know that there are human rights violations in parts of this world that are just tremendously, you know, unacceptable. And we know there's bad stuff going on out there. But he said, if you stood back and said, over the last 100 years, if you could write one headline for the last 100 years of history, what would that headline be? And his argument was, the West pushes back against fascism. And that's probably true. And that's something that was tremendously important and we should be proud of. And he said, if you looked at the last 50 years and said, what would the headline be? It would probably be, the world sees an unprecedented spike in wealth and bringing people into the middle class. That's not just in this country. That's in many parts of this country, or many parts of this world, rather, including China. And that, again, is a good thing.
Well, like 50 years ago, you're talking about
approximately
half the people in the world lived in what is considered extreme poverty, and now that's under 10%, I believe. I mean, that's a remarkable achievement.
Yeah, and those two things, you know, in effect, winning World War II and vanquishing communism were really important big things. And the upward mobility of probably billions of people is also a really big thing. And those are things that we just don't probably talk enough about.
The success that we've had in kind of many Western industrialized nations, that is the effect of the Enlightenment, that is the advance of the scientific method, and then the growth of these institutions, which are largely democratic institutions, which allow us to take this scientific knowledge that we've gained, develop it into solutions to real-world problems, and then fix the problems. And we've become so effective that, working both with government and non-governmental agencies, that I think we have an orientation towards identifying problems. Okay? So on the one hand, that's really good. If we're always focused on what is the next big problem, we have to kind of figure out what's causing it, what solution can we have, and then figure out how to implement that kind of solution effectively.
On a mass scale.
That's been our orientation, I think, as a global society, right? We've been so good at that, but the problem is then we're always focused on the next problem. And you know, so that's, in some ways, that's good. We're not being complacent about the causes of human suffering in the world. And yet, it doesn't really allow us to take a step back and just say, well, look at all the success we've achieved. I mean, this is really a good thing. And I think it certainly ought to be a part of the ways in which we teach history. You know, so much of teaching history is teaching history of governments and then big kind of global events, or, you know, like, wars and notable figures. But we don't teach much about just the kind of incremental progress that is made through, I would say, institutional effectiveness. And because that's not very interesting to look at incremental progress. But that's the story of the West over the last 100 years or so. Western societies, I would say, especially leading this change, has been the story of incremental progress through institutions.
And I think, and we'll link to this column, but the left-leaning columnist Matt Iglesias had a piece recently that looked at depression, and he in it even talked about some of the struggles he's had over the years with depression and their mental health issues. But the focus really on his piece was why the data shows young liberals among all groups are oftentimes the most depressed. And I think part of his argument is that, and just kind of what you're saying, is that a lot of times the change that people want to see for the world, whether it's around climate change, whether it's around social justice issues, often comes from the left, but these movements are no longer a forward-looking in a way about, you know, the changes that we can make and the good that can come from it. I think too often they have these doomer sort of approaches about it, and it just made me think a little bit. And I guess this is also something we've talked about from time to time too. But he brings up too, is how instinctively there's a group of people, often young people, who catastrophize just about everything. That whatever problem that's coming down the pipe is the worst problem we've ever seen, that may lead to the end of civilization as we know it, and we have to have acted yesterday or we probably can't do anything about it. I think you need some of that to get people to be less complacent and to pay attention. But goodness knows we could do a lot better job in getting people to make this change if we were probably a little more optimistic.
Well, certainly. I mean, optimistic people are generally much more effective at finding solutions to problems. And they're more motivated to do so. Because the more pessimistic you are, the less effective you think action will be, the less inclined you are to engage in it. And certainly aren't spending a lot of time thinking about how to get something done if you think there aren't any good solutions, right?
And I often at these times turn to your expertise because you spend a lot of time on a college campus and a lot of time around college age people and have for a long time. Do you see this, I'll call it more of a doomer mentality going on around your campus and among the students with whom you interact than you were 20 years ago or even 10 years ago?
Absolutely. And the more liberal both kind of faculty, staff, and students are, the more they tend to use on a regular basis words like harm, victim, deeply problematic, violence, victim. I mean, these words are throughout the deep discourse. And then if you respond in a way that seems to them to be too positive, it's a sign that you really aren't concerned about social justice or environmental justice.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a complex thing because it's kind of like the very language that is used in some ways to be, I think what many people think is just like to describe events. They aren't really taking themselves to be commenting on the moral wrongness of the event. They're just describing them, but they're using these really severe terms for many times things that would seem to be, I would say kind of ordinary wrongdoings or, you know, kind of ordinary challenges or ordinary like disagreements that people have are the extreme terms are used to describe them. Well, that, if you use these really extreme terms all the time, then it starts to seem like the world is really extreme. Things have never been worse.
Well, and also that viewpoint, and again, I think the studies show and your experiences also show that this may be among more liberal-minded people, but I would also say that conservatives are often guilty of this as well, and because it comes from both sides, that's why over the last, 15, 20 years, we no longer have political opponents. We have people we just hate. And I think that's tough to get things done. And I just don't see, and I think there's a lot of reasons why we've gotten to that point. Some of that has to do with some of the candidates who we've elected to really high office over the past few years. But also I think some of it just comes from this mentality of things are horrible and we just are going to be in an awful place unless we, if we elect that person, because and then you try to go deeper and like ask why, and sometimes that anger and hatred is really not very deeply plumbed.
So there is a kind of balance between like the kind of on the liberal and conservative sides. I mean, they're both, we're much more polarized. There's a tendency on both sides to do some kind of catastrophizing, especially as they get to the more extreme versions. But it's only on the left that you have the attempt to really change the entire language that we're using. You know, on the right, I mean, there's attention to certain kinds of words, but most of it is a reaction to changes that the left wants to make to everyday language. And I mean, I see it on campuses. This has always happened to some extent. I mean, in my 30 years in academics or so, it's always been present. But in the last 10 years, it's just really ramped up the way in which somebody is always challenging any way in which we might be describing people, and especially people that differ in some fashion from what's perceived to be the norm. And so that it becomes contentious even to try to make any claims about people. And this has led to what's well known as a problem of self-censorship among students because, you know, they're never sure who's going to challenge the appropriateness of their language. But so much of this language has the catastrophizing built right into it. And this is the problem. So do you have kind of a negative or kind of harmful viewpoint built right into the way we use language? And that's, I think Iglesias is right. Like, this is a problem among liberals, and maybe that's the effect we're seeing when we find that more liberal youth tend to be more depressed than conservative youth.
And just to kind of put a wrap on that topic, but to me it seems, though, that if you truly think these issues are important, and I think some of them really are, that to try to get people on your side, to try to get people to rally around your ideas, I think a positive, optimistic message is always, or always, almost always, going to be the winning argument. And I just don't know why there seems to be no realization of that.
Well, it's hard. I mean, you can't tell somebody who's kind of firmly entrenched in a really pessimistic mindset that they ought to be more optimistic, because they're going to challenge that. And Iglesias does a really nice job of describing this. He says, mentally processing ambiguous events with a negative spin is just what depression is. But this has become kind of the liberal response to so many things. You take something that's kind of ambiguous and you give it a negative spin. Well, if that becomes habitual, you're putting yourself in a depressive mindset. And then to argue that you ought to be more optimistic is, I mean, that's not very effective.
Another person who's done a lot of writing in this area is Derek Thompson. He works for the Atlantic, also has a podcast that has touched on these issues. And he's talked to a lot of folks who, again, talk about why young people are seeing these high levels of stress that especially have been coming on over the past 10 years and maybe even worse over the past few around the pandemic. And one term I've heard him talk about, and this is something that does not just affect young people, but I think especially affects young people, is their lack of social fitness. That when we don't talk a lot about that, is what he would say. You know, we talk a lot about physical fitness, and we know that if you are more physically fit person, you are much more likely to have a longer and happier life. The studies are showing more and more that being socially fit is also maybe as important, if not more important, than being physically fit in having a long and happy life.
Yeah, and there's a real push among some in especially in K-12 schools to do more what they call socio-emotional learning. And that is to really look at these questions of kind of social fit, both how you process your emotions, paying attention to relationships, the importance of relationships in the learning environment. And they've actually showed if teachers that focus on this will end up with students learning much better. I mean, so it's not something that you're sacrificing academic results, you're actually enhancing academic results. I would say one of the big challenges is some people are suspect. Is this are we getting into more values education and more directing kids towards having the right kinds of social attitudes? And where does that enter into the education process?
There are a surprising number of young people, especially college students, who identify themselves as lonely. And I can't think of a place that we've intentionally constructed in this country than a college campus where we take a bunch of people who are all about the same age and drop them on a fairly concentrated chunk of land and say, here's where you're going to live. Here's where you're going to meet a bunch of new people. Here's where you're going to learn a bunch of new and interesting things and actually get to pick a path of something that interests you that might sort of lead the rest of your professional career. It just seems like there's so many ways for young people in that setting to, you know, interact with others. You know, and goodness knows, there has been more than a few movies made around that kind of coming of age moment. It just seems so surprising to me, having not spent much time on college campuses over the past several decades, that is a place where anybody could be lonely, but it sounds like that happens a lot.
Loneliness is an interesting phenomenon because it's it's partly a matter of like having friends, but you can, I mean, you can be engaged in social activities quite a bit and still feel quite lonely if you feel like you don't fit in or you're unsure of your place. And so part of it is like, do you feel love? Do you feel acknowledged? And that comes from generally, you know, like close friendships. I've been thinking about this a lot because we've talked before about Jonathan Haidt's research and the use of social media and smartphones, and he really thinks the reason we have a sharp uptake in depression and anxiety among teens beginning in 2012. Because it's pretty much like historically the data is about the same, going, you know, up or down slightly for both boys and girls for a long time. At 2012, it goes up sharply. And this is just a few years after the introduction of both the iPhone and Instagram. And Instagram turns out to be correlated with much more depression, anxiety among girls than any of the other social media platforms because it's more image-based. So then you wonder, like, what's the connection between the like feeling like one belongs and feeling that one is loved, kind of having this sure sense of one's identity, a kind of a stable self. What's the connection between that and a real concern with status? And I think, see, this is what I think social media, especially these image-based platforms, do. And especially the girls that spend a lot of time on this, is they become concerned with their status, where their self-identity is really tied into how others perceive them.
And social media is built around kind of letting you easily see where you fit in that that status-based hierarchy.
Yeah, because you get, you know, the likes. Yep. So you get all these votes, you know, on how popular you are, but also then who responds and who doesn't, and then who responds negatively. I mean, these are all, you move up or down, and you can move up or down very quickly. But I think one of the key things is your status is always uncertain. There's a way in which your identity is determined by others. And we've known for a long time that this is not a good recipe for emotional health. You want to have a real confident sense of yourself as being loved. And one of the things that has made me think about it in this way is that it's not just the use of the media and the media platform, it's the way in which it changes the kind of the identity of the self as being a matter of status. And I've been following the research done by Josh Packard with Springtide Institute, who is looking at the attitude of young people towards religion. And he's finding like a huge difference between those who have some kind of connection with religion. That is that they say they find themselves connected to a higher power, whether that is through religious services or prayer or walks in nature, whatever it happens to be. Those who say they regularly feel themselves connected to a higher power are much, much more likely to say they feel good about themselves. And those who never have a connection to higher power are much more likely to find themselves feeling anxious or stressed. And I think that's this idea of feeling connected to a higher power is also a matter of like feeling oneself secure, like having a sense of one's identity as being rooted in something greater than oneself. And that's different than finding one's identity rooted in the varying opinions of a collection of peers.
One thing I've heard people say, and I tend to agree with, and I'll be curious what your thoughts are, is that if somebody told me that they're spending 2 hours, well, 4 hours a week extra on social media than they used to, but that's replacing time where they might watch TV or Netflix or something, to me, I'd be like not especially concerned. But I'm afraid why we should be concerned is that's not what's happening. It's actually replacing time spent in person with other people. And I think that is really what's missing not just among young people, but around people in general, is that we're just not spending enough time together. And that was happening before the pandemic. The pandemic obviously caused that to change, at least for a while, and probably appropriately so. But now, as that's mostly behind us, it just doesn't seem like we've really bounced back at all from that. And I think, unfortunately, we're just not seeing as much of our friends and family in person. And gosh, I think that that's just not a good thing.
Yeah, that's another reason to, like, a causal explanation of why the time spent on social media might be correlated with this higher rates of anxiety and depression, is that it's just replacing, you know, quality time developing friendships.
Yeah, it's, you can develop some sort of familiarity with people online, but it's nothing like being in the same room with people.
I'm more and more convinced that a huge part of this is like status versus kind of a robust sense of a self that is loved, which is known by others and acknowledged. And I think this goes back to John Bowlby. He was a British psychoanalyst and psychologist who formulated something called attachment theory. But he wrote in a book called A Secure Base, he talked about the child who is raised by loving parents is much more likely to develop a confident self that is ready to go out and explore the world. Whereas the child that is always unsure of whether it is loved or not is much more likely to remain attached, but remain attached in an unhealthy way. And so, I think that Bowlby is looking just at, like, very early childhood, but I think it's something that persists. I mean, there's a way in which if you reach maturity, you reach your teen years anyway, and you have some really good friendships, you kind of know, like, where you stand in relation to others. And so then if somebody insults you or says something mean to you, like, certainly that's might make for a bad day, but it doesn't cause you to question your self-identity. It doesn't cause you to question your self-worth in the same way. It's just a bad experience. If you don't have those solid friendships to fall back on to provide that secure base, then critical remarks can be just devastating because they go right to the core of who you are.
And they make you question who you really are.
Yeah, and this is so, like, for Freud, who distinguishes between grief and depression, he calls it mourning and melancholia, but it's like grief is the loss of something or someone you love in the world, but depression is kind of in a way the loss of the whole world, because you can't distinguish yourself from the world, right? You haven't been able to individuate, and so then when something bad happens, suddenly everything in the world loses value, and you can't find any sunshine in it anymore. And this seems, I think, to be what's happening to so many of our young people. And it may be part of the reason for this catastrophizing language, that it really is the experience. Like, it feels to them like if somebody says something negative to them, like it's destroyed them. And so then you can start to see why they talk of this as being like words are violence. Well, I think if you have a really good sense of who you are and you know that you're loved, somebody says something insulting and you just shake your head and say, you know, like, what an idiot. But if you don't have this really good, well-established sense of yourself as someone who is loved, and somebody says something negative to you, it just destroys your world. And that's, I think we need to pay much more attention to how are we helping young people to establish a secure sense of their identity. And I don't think it can just be by controlling an environment in which nobody ever says anything bad to them. Like, that's the wrong way to go about it.
Well, and you mentioned the important role parents play, and certainly they do. One thing Derek Thompson touches on briefly in his piece is something he refers to as modern parenting styles, and how some parents go out of their way, and probably too far out of their way, to protect their children from any conflict or any situation with where the child might be uncomfortable. And you were talking about someone who's confident in who they are. And I think, personally, that confidence is sort of an undervalued trait in our society. And I can't imagine that a child who's grown up with a parent who is always protecting them, and I don't mean from all danger, there's certainly legitimate things parents do and should protect them, their children from, but I think the example that was given in the piece was that if your kid has a somewhat negative reaction as a youngster to a dog, that some parent might be, well, Susie's afraid of dogs and we can never go to a house that has a dog again. Well, that's probably not a great idea because a lot of people have dogs and that sort of narrows her experience. And instead, kind of talking to her and saying, you know, hey, you know, that dog was a bad dog, but, you know, most dogs are probably fine, and sort of give her the confidence to face that. And I don't think all parents are guilty of overprotecting their kids, but I bet you think some of them are.
I know some of them are, and I've talked to teachers about this too, about the, you know, different approaches in the classroom that teachers have towards, for example, setting really clear boundaries, behavioral boundaries. And it turns out like most kids do better with you know, fairly kind of explicit but consistently held boundaries. And because what happens in the absence of that, they're all vying with one another for kind of finding out what's acceptable and what isn't. And this creates a great deal of uncertainty and anxiety. So that the very attempt not to say anything to children that makes them upset kind of creates more stress and anxiety for them. And I think that's something that, you know, there's a great number of people in our society don't quite understand how not saying things that are disagreeable might cause more stress and anxiety.
I mean, there's the old, I would say old adage. That's one of my pet peeves, by the way. All adages are old. So I'll just say there's the adage.
There's the adage.
That you should never talk about religion or politics, you know, around, you know, Thanksgiving tables or any tables maybe. And then there's some people push back on that and say, no, those are important parts of our world. And we should learn how to talk about those things in like responsible and rational ways. What side of that equation do you sit?
I think we should talk about religion and politics all the time. I mean, they're two of my favorite topics. I mean, I enjoy
and
talking
I mean, are,
about
but
them.
Are being around, I mean, knowing your viewpoints, and are there certain people you just say, well, whenever I'm around Uncle Fred, I'm just not going to go there? Or do you go there maybe in just more gentle ways?
I tend to go there in more gentle ways, but I have been told by some of my family members, we're going to have a gathering where we're just not going to talk about politics this time. And so I can respect that. I don't mind respectful conflict. Mm-hmm. And I think that just makes things more interesting. I can understand why it's hard for people to sometimes, you know, participate in discussions in which their certain kinds of core beliefs are always being challenged, especially if they're ones where they're like they don't on a regular basis talk about these things, because then it there are a lot of confusing things about beliefs that I would say that we regard as very important to who we are, that are also hard for us to explain. And so sometimes those conversations can be very difficult.
But don't you think if they are hard to explain, that those discussions are a better chance not to change your mind, but to maybe understand your mind a little better, that you can kind of, as you're talking it through with someone who truly is listening to you, you kind of not only learn about that person's viewpoint more, but also learn more about yours as well.
Absolutely. And that's why I believe in talking about them. But not everybody is capable of, I would say, talking about them in a way that is charitable and, you know, or what we often say is civil. And so at the point where that discussion erupts into anger, then you have to say, okay, we're maybe not making any productive leeway here, so we might as well just call an end to it today. But I think it's like politics, like in a very general sense. This is a matter of how we decide to share or shape a common life. And so this is a really important thing to talk about together, especially to talk about with people that we know and we trust, and where we have some kind of mutual respect or goodwill. And so among family members, this should be something that we can talk about quite a bit.
And just to kind of put a button on this, but just to also go back to the start of this conversation, having been in those talks with friends and family members that are, especially with people who don't always agree with me, I'll tell you, one of the most disarming things you can say is frame the discussion in an optimistic way. Like, here's how I think America could be better. Here's what we could do to make the progress around topic X even more successful than it's ever been before. And I think too often when we have those discussions, where people always approach things in a negative way. And I'll tell you, to talk about how you want to make the country better and stronger and a place where you want to raise a family, I mean, geez, that's a much, in my opinion, much better way to start that conversation.
Absolutely. And yet, kind of so many of the people that make politics a high priority in their lives are watching the most extreme networks, right? And those tend to be networks in which a lot of what passes for political discussion is actually blame. Participating in a blame contest with people is not fun. It's also not productive. And so I can see why people don't like to have those kind of talks if their experience of it is just casting blame at one another. But if you can frame it in a positive way and ask, well, like, how can we make this better? That's a great thing to do.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here's my question for you. And an ethics podcast requires me to tell you that this was inspired by a question I read in the New York Times in their ethicist column. Rick, you're the boss of about 20 people. Fred, who has been with the company for 10 years, has become a poor performer over the past 12 months. You've coached him, but you don't see any improvement. Just as you get ready to fire him, his father dies suddenly. How does this affect how you proceed?
I think in a case like that, I would delay the firing unless there was like a real significant consequences, say to the company, of keeping Fred employed for another month or so.
Like if he was like overtly harassing people or stealing money or.
Oh yeah. If there was some ethical misconduct or illegal activity, then that the person needs to be dismissed immediately. But if it's just a matter of like, no, Fred needs to go, we need to get in somebody in here who can really do the job. And one of the reasons why it's also an ethical responsibility, if you're in a supervisory role, to get into somebody who can really do the job, is because Fred's probably working with a team of other people and others are having to do more work to take up the slack for somebody who's not performing. And so you have an obligation to your employees who are doing the work, who are working really hard taking up the slack, to get somebody in there who can be a good teammate for them. But in a case like this, I mean, it's just part of the duty of compassion, I think, to say, okay, let's delay this for another month or so. Let Fred deal with the grief. You know, you don't want to compound the grief by loss of a parent and loss of a job.
And would you worry at all? Again, you kind of approach this from the side of, you know, other people on the team are probably well aware that Fred's not been pulling his weight for a while. Are you also, though, worried about, you know, obviously, we'll assume everybody on the team knows that Fred's dad just died. Are you worried at all about the perception that, oh, well, geez, I work for some boss who doesn't much care about that. If, you know, a month after his dad died, he's out the door. I mean, is that something, I guess, when talking to the rest of the people? Is that something you would even address in any way? Or do you just feel like your past performance or as a boss would hopefully illustrate that you're not that bad actor?
I think that depends a great deal on the size of the organization. You know, so how many people are you talking about? If you're working with a really small team, you probably do have informal conversations of this sort on a regular basis, and you might want to explain your reasoning. You might already have the kind of relationship where people might ask you, how did you determine the timing of this? But if it's a really large organization, and lots of times then you have much more formal process and more formal lines of communication, you wouldn't say anything. But I would be much more worried about the perception of, say, firing Fred just as you find out that his father dies and what that communicates about your lack of compassion. Because whatever you do to Fred, this isn't interpreted, and I think interpreted rightly, as like this is how you will treat everybody else on that team. And so you want to also act in a way that signals the way in which you care about everybody that reports to you.
I'm just going to frame up the situation a little differently before we go. So we're going to take the father's death out of it entirely.
Yeah.
That this is a guy who's worked there for 10 years. Let's say you've supervised him for all those 10 years. And for the first 9 years, he was a top-notch performer. And the last year, he's demonstratively not. Do you give someone like that more slack or more time to sort of self-correct versus someone who had been there a year and seemed to do fine and then, you know, just sort of started fading rather quickly in performance? Do you owe that employee a little more because of the time put in?
I think, yeah, you owe the employee more, but also you have a track record to go on to show that here's an employee who can really do the work. So something must be wrong. So you want to find out, like, what's going on. That can be hard to do. So, I mean, Fred himself may not be quite aware of what's going on, mm-hmm. you know. But I think you owe an employee like that where you've developed a relationship. You owe that employee a little more leeway and time to correct the problems.
I'm gonna throw one more curveball at you. So we're going to go back to Fred's dad's dead. But in the first scenario I gave you, I said he died suddenly. He was out, you know, on a golf course one day, had a heart attack, dropped over dead. In this scenario, I'll give you the final one. He's been battling a long-term disease that you've known about and has been going on for a period of time that closely mirrors Fred's downturn in performance. And the two of them, Fred and his father, live in the same city, and Fred talks about his dad quite a bit, and Fred sort of even updates you from time to time about how his health is declining. Does that change the calculus on this?
Yeah. I think it was Max Dupree who said leadership means getting involved in the messiest parts of other people's lives, right? And there are cases like this where you just have to say, well, what's our capacity as a team? What's the capacity for me as a leader for like helping to support Fred during this time and maybe picking up some slack? What's the capacity of our team for doing that? And sometimes you have that capacity and sometimes you don't, because that what's happening with Fred isn't happening in a vacuum. You also have other people who have other kinds of challenges in their lives as well. And so you have to really pay attention to like if you're picking up the slack for Fred, what is this doing to everybody else? And is this putting more pressure on people who don't have the capacity for dealing with it right now? Or, you know, do we have that capacity? And can we put up with this? I mean,
and if you do, how long do you let Fred sort of get back to his previous performance levels? I mean, it's not going to happen the day after the funeral, probably. But right. Do you give him a month, 2 months, 3 months?
Yeah, I think again, that depends on like that performance gap, how great is it, and what's your capacity. So again, you know, these are judgment calls. It's mm-hmm. hard to say, but like we do have a duty of compassion towards one another. And I mean, even in business decisions where if you're operating a business, you have to be meeting goals in order to keep the business viable, because that's what is allowing you to be a benefit to everybody, you know, to support a number of different families or individuals. But there's usually some elasticity in kind of what the demands are for different people. And a really high-functioning team, you're going to have, you know, some people are performing really optimally or beyond expectations at some point. Others are performing below, but you try to develop a team where there's some give and take here in what the expectations are, and there's a balancing out. What you don't want is at some point to have some people on that team who are always putting additional stress on others who are then overperforming to compensate for them. That's what I would watch out for. You know, if you have to give Fred 2 or 3 months, if you have that capacity, that's good, because at some point, Fred's going to be called upon to do extra while somebody else needs some help.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and this week about depression and youth and all the stuff we talked about earlier in the show. That can be found on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.